serving, and studying in Afghanistan today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Almost 17 years ago, the attacks of 9/11 pushed America into war in Afghanistan. We speak today with an Army intelligence officer who was just 7 years old on that day. Now she's serving in Kandahar, Afghanistan.
It is weird being here for 9/11. Definitely has personal meaning to me, given that my dad was actually in New York City during the time of the attacks.
Plus, we stay in Afghanistan to hear from students who lived through a Taliban attack on their university campus in Kabul. One said she couldn't sleep for days afterwards.
Every night, it was like a movie repeating in my dreams.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. And today, for one woman, this is what it felt like in Afghanistan.
It is weird being here for 9/11. Definitely has personal meaning to me, given that my dad was actually in New York City during the time of the attacks.
That's First Lieutenant Erica McSwan, currently stationed in Kandahar, Afghanistan. The 24-year-old Army intelligence officer was just seven on 9/11.
So I was in second grade, and at the time we were living in New Hampshire. My dad was commuting into New York City for most weeks, working at IBM. So he had a meeting just downtown, a couple blocks away from the World Trade Centers. And this was all told to me after the fact when I was picked up from school, actually. But he came out of the subway, and at that point it was about 9:45. He had a 10 a.m. meeting a couple blocks from the World Trade Center, and he immediately looked up. Both towers had been hit at that point, and he talked to an individual next to him and said, "Wow, this is crazy." And the guy said that he was late for work and he had worked on the 104th floor and all of his coworkers are up there. So Then my dad gave his condolences and went on his way, said that he had to unfortunately make this 10 a.m. meeting. But obviously, the first tower fell at 9:59, so soon he was overcome by people screaming and running past him. So he looked behind to see the towers were collapsing, and he began running as well. However, he didn't get far until he described it like a black blanket covered him, and the city went completely silent. And he was fortunate that he basically created a sort of way to breathe with his jacket, took his jacket off and created a way to breathe, but it was still difficult given the smog and the debris and the smoke. But he just began praying and then heard the church bells go off, which the 10 a.m. church bells. So he looked up and saw a light and kind of scrambled to his feet. And I would assume that it was a firefighter or police officer that had the light that was looking around the debris, My dad just happened to see that, and the firefighter or police officer led him to safety in a building a few blocks away.
What a dramatic memory. Can you make the connection between that day and what you were feeling getting the news from your dad and where you are today in Afghanistan?
Yes, I think the entire war has evolved, obviously, since that time, and the strategy has evolved, given the enemy's changing strategy and changing posture as well. But I definitely still feel that connection. And for me, it's pretty personal just because my dad obviously was there. And so I have a special connection to feel that I'm protecting my family and those back home by being here. And kind of being at the forefront of fighting those who want to inflict harm onto the U.S. and to other other people across the world. So definitely do feel a personal connection.
So I don't want to make you all homesick, but I hear you're a fan of the New England Patriots. Did you get to see any of the game on Sunday?
I did, yes. So I just stayed up later than normal to watch the game.
Right.
So AFN definitely does a great job of supporting the troops in terms of providing shows and games.
Armed Forces Network.
Home. That is, yes.
Yeah.
Armed Forces Network.
So what do you miss most about the States?
I would say traveling. That's definitely the hardest part about being out here is I love traveling and going hiking. And obviously those things are not available here. So I'm looking forward to that when I get back.
Lieutenant, we're about to hear a story from Kabul, something that is not what a lot of people expect to hear about Afghanistan. It's a story about dorm life among women at the university. So maybe you can also give us kind of an atypical parting shot. I gather you love to watch the sunsets in Kandahar. So we're talking with you around the end of the day Afghan time. How is the sundowner today? Do you have any special rituals around sunset?
I wouldn't say special rituals, but I do like going out there. Oftentimes we'll be launching an aircraft around that time, so it's awesome to be able to watch the sunset and kind of the contrast of nature and the peace of nature with the sunset and the mountains in the background, and then with our aircraft in the foreground preparing to launch and conduct our mission. So it definitely is an interesting image, but it is nice that I can still enjoy that being here, and sometimes I'll go on night runs as well to see the sunset, so it is nice to be able to experience the calm of nature despite the busyness of the deployment.
Lieutenant Erica McSwan, serving in Afghanistan, speaking with us from Kandahar Base. Thank you, and thank you for your service, Lieutenant.
Thank you very much.
That is quite the image, those planes and that sunset. Not quite 17 years that the U.S. has been in Afghanistan, and aside from that American military presence, the U.S. has left a lasting impact on many aspects of life in the country. The effort to rebuild Afghanistan's educational system, for instance. Results have been mixed, but in the early 2000s, the U.S. helped establish Afghanistan's first private university. The American University of Afghanistan had the backing of former First Lady Laura Bush, and over time it's become a symbol of hope for many young Afghan men and women who dream about higher education. The irony, as the world's Shirin Jafari now tells us, having that education also makes us students and their campus in Kabul targets for extremists.
August 2016, a little after 7 p.m., classes were wrapping up for the day at the American University in Kabul.
Witnesses say a large explosion blew one of the gates open.
Militants drove two trucks full of explosives into the surrounding walls of the campus. Then they stormed in, opening fire on students and staff.
Others hid where they could. One jumped from a second-story window to escape.
I didn't know anything, what to do and how to rescue myself.
Zakira Rasuli had just started university that week. She was heading back to her dorm room when the attack began.
They were firing and shooting. And like, actually, I could not run. I mean, I don't know why, but still, that fear would stop me. It was so difficult to even run, to escape.
At that moment, all Rasuli could think of was her mother.
I was crying out, what will happen to my mother? What will everyone tell my mother? And I'm sure they will blame my mother.
Rasuli's mother, a widow, had made the decision to send her here to study in Kabul. But sending an 18-year-old hundreds of miles away from home by herself, that was just unheard of in her family.
I knew that I should not die because my mother would not live, because everyone will blame her, because she sent me. She wanted me to reach my dreams.
Rasuli hid in the basement of the university for 9 hours. By the time it was all over, more than a dozen people were killed. Students, teachers, security guards. Rasuli was lucky. She survived, uninjured. Today, the American University in Kabul looks like a prison. The campus is surrounded by tall, thick concrete walls topped with barbed wire. There are watchtowers with armed guards looking down. My producer, Andrea Carson, and I approached the university gates. There's a guard in a bulletproof vest with an AK-47 slung over his shoulder. He summons us inside the trailer where we begin the process of security checks.
Assalamu alaikum.
A friendly and, well, thorough woman pats us down multiple times. Vigorously. I ask her if everyone has to go through this to get inside. Oh yes, she says. No one sets foot on this campus unless they go through these searches. An hour later, and we're in. Here we are, finally. The American University of Afghanistan was founded 3 years after the U.S.-led invasion and the fall of the Taliban government. It was part of the Bush administration's efforts to rebuild the country's education system. There are currently 1,700 students enrolled,
many of whom live in dorms on campus.
Hi, good. How are you? Thank you so much.
Is this your dorm?
Yes. Excellent.
Zakira Rasuli and some of her college friends invite us into their dorm.
Yeah, let's sit on the floor. It'll be more comfortable. Yeah, if everyone just kind of wants to sit around, make a semicircle around.
Like Rasuli, many of the women here are not from Kabul. They come from all over the country. And inside these metal gates of the university, they've created a sort of sisterhood.
So you spend a lot of time here together. What do you do to have fun?
Lots of fun, okay.
Because we know mostly we are living here and we are not going outside, we actually trying to provide more fun. We have dance party, we have tea talk, and we have movie night as well.
What's the popular movie among the girls here?
Most of the girls, yeah. Mostly Indian, Bollywood, they like, yeah, and horror movies.
Yeah, they watch horror movies.
That's fun, you know, like everyone is watching it and like shouting together with friends.
What we are seeing today would not have been possible 2 decades ago in Afghanistan. When the Taliban came to power in the 1990s, they banned education for girls and women. 23-year-old Masuma Kohandal says her mom was one of them.
My mom has 12th grade education. Because of civil war, because of Taliban attacks, she could not continue her education. And that's why she is just motivating me that you should get a higher education and you should be successful.
What these women share is a sense of duty to get an education, not just to their mothers who couldn't, but also to other young women they left behind in their hometowns. Parveen Summer is a law student.
I am the only girl from my family and from my whole tribe that I am the only one. I came to the university and far away from my province and study here. My classmate at the school, they get married and now they have children.
She says every time she talks on the phone with them, she tells them not to be discouraged.
I'm talking with them a lot of time, you know, say continue the studies. If you have the planning of study, I will help you every time. We are showing the way and we are a kind of role model for them.
Summer knows she's lucky. This is a private university and it costs about $1,000 a year. That's a fortune here. But Summer has a full ride. She and most of the students here have scholarships that pay for tuition, food, housing, all of it.
Do you like it?
Yeah, of course we like it.
The women say they feel safe inside this dorm, and inside is where they stay. The Taliban still threatens and attacks schools in Afghanistan, which is why these students don't leave campus except once or twice a semester to visit their families in the provinces.
When I go out of the university, I don't feel like secure. Living in here, though it has a lot of security measurements, security restrictions, but still we feel safe and we feel secure.
For these young women, just being here is an achievement. Yes, they've witnessed murder on their campus. Yes, they're stuck in what's more or less a prison. And yes, they know they could be killed for pursuing a college education. But they also know that this is their way of fighting back against extremist groups like the Taliban.
You know, they are against everything, against education, against everything in this country. That's why they're trying to stop us from improving, because if we improve a lot, then we will stop them.
As I leave the dorm, I come across a mural. It shows 2 students with backpacks. Next to them, it reads, "I'm back because education prevails." For The World, Shirin Jafari, Kabul, Afghanistan.
Young women in Kabul hanging out, dance parties, watching movies, you know, life. They also care about what they wear. Kabul has a growing fashion industry. And tomorrow, Shirin meets one of the country's up-and-coming fashion designers at a photo shoot, trying her best to find the motivation for her models.
Like, look at that flame, you know, it's burning.
It's not quite a Vogue cover yet, but the flame of Kabul's fashionistas is starting to burn bright. That's coming up on the show tomorrow. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Last month, we reported on a startling forecast by the International Monetary Fund. The IMF predicted that the rate of inflation in Venezuela would reach a mind-boggling 1,000,000% by December. What does that huge number mean? Well, let's just say the Venezuelan economy is in free fall. Basic goods are so scarce that prices are skyrocketing. To keep up, the government has tried printing new currency notes with lots of added zeros. When they ran out of space on the paper bills, officials reversed course and slashed zeros from the currency. Bottom line, hyperinflation means that any money Venezuelans have today could be practically worthless by tomorrow. Gold, on the other hand, gold usually holds its value, and that's why the Venezuelan government is now letting ordinary citizens buy gold, or at least saving certificates backed up by gold.
People must go to the Venezuelan Central Bank, and they have two options. They can pay 3,500 bolivars for 1.5 grams of gold, or they can pay 5,800 bolivars for 2.5 grams of gold.
That's BBC Mundo's Venezuela correspondent Guillermo Olmo. To put those prices in U.S. dollar terms, Venezuelans can buy 1.5 grams of gold for a little over $60. 2.5 grams will set you back $100 or so. Olmo is not so sure the plan's going to work.
I don't think it's likely because, if you think of how much it costs, considering the rate at what dollar is being traded on Venezuelan streets, this means that for getting one of these small grains of gold, you have to pay the equivalent of a minimum month salary. And so in a context where basic goods are becoming unaffordable for a lot of Venezuelans due to the spiraling prices, going up, it's hard to see how they are going to find money to spare or invest in gold. It's something that I don't think is going to happen, or at least it's not going to happen for a majority of them. Some of the Venezuelans I've told, they were so reluctant in investing in this, even the merchants that perhaps can have some stock of money for doing this, because they are not even given the gold. What they will receive if they pay the money is some sort of certificate from the Venezuelan Central Bank attesting that they own that piece of gold. And as one of these merchants put to me, he said, if I don't trust them when they are printing money, why should I trust them when they are printing a piece of paper saying that I own a speck of gold? And I would say that's the thinking of a lot of people here in Venezuela.
Yeah, hate to be cynical, but that'd be my outlook too. The BBC's Guillermo Olmo telling us there about Venezuela's new tool against hyperinflation, gold. Collecting water from fog and kids learning how to edit video. There is a connection, and you'll find it in Morocco, thanks to a woman named Jamila Bargash. Rebecca Rossman has this profile from the city of Agadir.
It's a breezy, warm day in Agadir, a sleepy Moroccan city facing the Atlantic. But Manal Teragroom is not outside enjoying the sunshine. Today, she's sitting in a classroom with 20 other girls who are learning the fundamentals of social media, digital photography, and even basic computer coding. The 14-year-old says she's looking forward to learning how to edit videos and photos. In Morocco, girls, especially poor girls, are rarely, if ever, given the opportunity to learn these kinds of skills.
This is a possibility for them to discover something that's totally, totally different from their world.
Jamila Bargash runs Darcy Hamed, the NGO that created this tech camp for girls.
In a way, we're doing this summer tech camp because these girls are in that world in which I also lived for a long time.
That world Bargash is talking about is her own country, Morocco, where 40% of women are illiterate and many of the laws are stacked against them.
Especially among rural women. The women are the poorest in this country. You have women still suffering from different legal discriminations.
For many years, women could be married off as early as the age of 15. They couldn't file for divorce. They had no legal right to obtain custody of their own children. Even though Bargash grew up in a well-educated family in the capital, she too found the opportunities for women to be few. In order to get her PhD in anthropology, she had to travel to the U.S.
And I was very frustrated with the possibilities that my family and my world gave me, that I couldn't go out, that why is it that this person could do this and I couldn't?
In 2000, she returned to Morocco and got a job as an anthropology professor. While teaching, she also ran a women's shelter. At the time, women who had children out of wedlock or women who ran away from their husbands could be thrown in jail. And protecting them, as Barghash did, was considered a crime.
I felt helpless because the changes were very few in terms of the breadth of a problem.
Barghash stepped down after realizing she could be more effective in other ways. That's when she became head of the Moroccan NGO Darcy Hamed. One of her main projects is helping the people of Ait Bamran, a mountainous village near the Sahara, produce clean water. Through a system that the NGO funds, the villagers derive water from fog, which they capture with nets installed on the mountaintops. Back 125 miles north in Agadir, the girls are finishing up their 10 days of digital skills training. One of their teachers is 24-year-old Hafida Mazoud. Mazoud is a graduate of another program Barghash's NGO offers to high school students to help them develop job skills.
They believed in me, even I didn't believe in myself at the beginning. It was actually a great experience for me.
Mazoud has a master's in food science, and she says before she met Jamila Barghash, she planned to work for a private company. But now she'll focus on advocacy work, particularly for Moroccan women.
In Morocco, we have less women in power, and actually to see a woman like Jamila, she accomplished many accomplishments.
The girls are singing goodbye songs, and the hope is that after they leave this tet camp, they'll see that so much more is possible for them. But Barghash says empowering Moroccan women is only one half of the battle.
We need to also accept to see and work with the men, because you can do all the efforts you want with the women. The women will go out, you know, and have a life of their own, do something. But the reality is, as long as you treated only the women, giving them the tools, and you're not treating the men, then it's not going to happen.
Changing attitudes of men and women across Moroccan society is a challenge Barghash says she will continue to fight. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Agadir, Morocco.
The rise of the far right in Europe has some people rattled, including folks at European Union headquarters. That's coming right up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. People in the Horn of Africa have lived through war for most of the last 20 years, but the news from there recently has been very different.
It is remarkable that in the space of really a couple months that you could see all of this historic angst and rivalry just disappear.
More on that still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. That's the leader of Hungary addressing the European Parliament today. Prime Minister Viktor Orbán accused his critics there of insulting the honor of his country. Orbán lashed out as the European Parliament began debating whether to censure him for allegedly violating European Union rules. That vote comes tomorrow. Let's turn now to the BBC's Nick Thorpe in Budapest for Viktor Orban's backstory.
He's a very pugnacious, very successful politician. He's just won his third consecutive term in office in April, and he's what one might call, he believes in a majoritarian version of democracy. In other words, the winner takes all. And he's pushed through many laws, a whole new constitution in Hungary in the past 8 years, which his critics, especially liberal or left-wing social democratic critics, believe actually undermine the rule of law. Mr. Orbán replied very defiantly in Parliament that if his own people were voting for him and kept re-electing him, surely they can't think that the rule of law or democracy is in danger, and therefore the European Parliament is interfering in his view and insulting not only his government and his person, but the Hungarian people, the Hungarian nation, as he put it.
So tomorrow the European Parliament votes on this censure measure for Orbán. If that vote passes, then what happens?
It's not certain it will pass, first of all, but it's certainly looking more likely this evening, or rather after this debate, than it was before. And that's because a lot of Mr. Orban's allies, fellow conservatives, fellow Christian Democrats in the European Parliament, really feel that he's now gone too far, attacking the Central European University, for example, attacking non-governmental organisations that stand up for the rights of asylum seekers and so on. They feel very uncomfortable with that. That was very apparent in the speeches. What might happen, though, if this vote goes against him? Basically, this would be a milestone, a hitherto unreached milestone in the criticism, in the sanctioning of a country. Then the possibility of Hungary losing its voting rights within the EU moves one step forward. But there's still a long way to go with that. It's very hard for the EU to criticize countries that are already members of it. Mm. Others, allies of Hungary, in particular Poland, could veto that. So it would be a symbolic defeat for Mr. Orban. But he's already looking, in a way, beyond tomorrow's vote to next May's European parliamentary elections, when he's confident that the votes of many Europeans will be against migration, will support his view that Europe needs to strengthen its outer borders to end Muslim immigration in particular to Europe, and that more nationalist-minded parties, more like his own party, will be elected.
One last thing, Nick, about Viktor Orban. George Soros, the billionaire Hungarian investor known for his commitment to human rights and civil society, he's got something of a mixed reputation in Hungary, but he and Orban actually go back a ways, don't they?
They go back a very long time, yes. I've been meeting George Soros when he comes to visit Hungary since the late 1980s. I think Mr. Soros actually first set up his Open Society Foundation in Hungary in 1984, if I remember rightly. He played a big role in, for example, providing photocopying machines to Hungarian secondary schools in the 1980s, which, of course, had quite a subversive role in those days because students were using them, teachers were using them to produce leaflets criticizing the single-party rule, the communist rule. And at that time, Mr. Soros and Mr. Orban got on very well. Mr. Orban was a recipient of a one-year scholarship to Pembroke College in Oxford in Britain. And likewise, many other figures in his party were recipients then. They were seen as really the young liberal hope, in a way, in the post-communist era. But as time went by, they became more, some would say, nationalist or more reactionary, certainly more conservative. And that put them at loggerheads with Mr. Soros's vision of an open society, which has always very much motivated him as a philanthropist.
The BBC's Nick Thorpe speaking with us from Budapest. Thanks very much for your time, Nick.
Thank you, Marco.
Viktor Orban is part of the European wave of populist leaders, a wave that seems to have empowered racists. And that's what this next story is about. Cecile Djunga does the weather on Belgium's French language public TV. She also happens to have another career on the side as a stand-up comedian. And this week she posted a video online saying that as a TV presenter, she's regularly the target of racist comments because she is black. Cecile Djunga says one recent comment really stood out. What did this recent viewer tell you?
It was a woman. She called at my office and she said that I was too black and she can't see me and that it was a problem. And so my colleague said, okay, it's maybe your TV. It's your TV. And she said, no, it's not my TV. It's her. And first I laugh about that because I am a comedian, so I make laugh about it, and it's my way to fight it. So I decided to make a video, and first I wanted to tell my followers that, oh, you know, today I have something to tell you, something crazy and something maybe fun. And after I began to be angry, and after I become emotional, and I just cried because it was too much.
You say in this video that this happens to you a lot, that you get comments about being black and being on TV. And it's true. In this video, you go through a whole range of emotions, starting, as you say, laughing about it, and then you get angry. And by the end, you're basically in tears. Why did this moment send you over the edge?
Sorry, can you repeat it?
Je veux savoir pourquoi ces commentaires, cette critique, cette fois-ci, vous a tellement dérangé, parce que c'est quelque chose qui s'est passé plusieurs fois pour vous, n'est-ce pas?
Yes, because I'm fed up of all these things, you know. I live with racism since I'm born.
And you're born in Belgium, yeah?
I'm born in Belgium. I am a really Belgian girl, you know. And when people say, oh, you are not Belgian, you are not a real Belgian girl, we want white people on the TV, go back to your country. When people say that, it's like, no, I can't go back to my country. Here is my country, you know?
What kind of reactions have you gotten from people on social media to your video and to the insult that was called into the station?
Oh, people send a lot of very positive comments, a lot of support, but know that I'm exposed to the media. You know, maybe I become
kind of a symbol of
yeah,
blackness.
Yeah, and so people continue to write me some things very bad. But I'm happy and I'm very glad that this video has made this impact on people.
Were you surprised by the nasty comments?
Yes, yes. I'm surprised because I thought that in Belgium it was not like that. It hurts, you know, and it's not normal. But
as you said, you're from Belgium, you're born in Belgium. Are your parents still there?
Yes, my mother is still there. She's there since 50 years.
Mm. What was it like for your mother to see you go through this?
She was very affected because she passed through very bad time. She came in 70. You know, it's the first immigration, la première vague d'immigration.
The first wave of immigration, yeah.
Yeah, elle a vécu beaucoup de racisme.
She's lived with a lot of racism.
Yeah, a lot. And she raised us to be very strong and to work a lot and to be better than white. We have to be better than white people. Mm. And I was not understanding that when I was little. No, I understand that. We have to fight harder. And I think in Belgium, we don't have more diversity on TV.
I was going to ask you, how many people of color are on Belgian news television?
I'm like the only one.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting, too, that, you know, this is something that also happens in the United States for journalists of color who often get blindsided by nasty comments from listeners or readers.
Yeah, and it's really hard in your country. And when I imagine that, I'm like, wow. I don't know how people deal with that in your country, because here it's okay. I receive some comments, but I am not in the 50 in US, you know?
What would you say is the difference between being a journalist of color in the US and being a journalist of color in Belgium?
Because here we didn't have a segregation, you know, we don't have the same past. I think it's more open here in Europe. It's less difficult, but the racism is there too. It's everywhere.
You said laughing about this stuff has been typically your way of dealing with it. Does your work as a comedian must also help a lot?
Yeah, it helps me because if I wasn't a comedian, I think I can deal with that.
Thanks very much for your time and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you very much for calling me. Thank you.
Cécile Djunga, stand-up comedian and weather presenter, yeah, on Belgium's public television. There's a tentative peace breaking out on the Horn of Africa. Today, scenes of joy as Ethiopians and Eritreans gathered on the border between their two nations and cheered, hugged one another, and wept. The crowd was celebrating the reopening of a border crossing. It had been shut down since war broke out between the two nations 20 years ago. This open border crossing is just the latest sign of a new beginning for a region more used to war than peace.
It is a sea change in the regional environment.
That's Boston University's Michael Woldemariam. He says Ethiopians and Eritreans are already benefiting from the thaw in relations.
People can actually travel between the two countries. There are now direct flights between the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa and the Eritrean capital of Asmara. There were a lot of families that were divided, you know, friendships that were severed or separated because of the conflict. And so now a lot of these people are sort of linking back up with one another. And you've heard some really sort of heartwarming stories about children that haven't seen their parents in decades, siblings that haven't seen one another in a really long time.
Woldemariam says these longtime enemies in the Horn of Africa have moved toward reconciliation with astonishing speed.
What's happened in really over the course of the last few weeks is that we've seen a number of peace deals emerge between countries that had been rivals for a long period of time, and that's really created a sense of optimism across the region about the prospects for peace, regional integration, and development. So to be more specific, there was a really landmark rapprochement between Eritrea and Ethiopia, right? That's something that unfolded in July.
Right.
And that has paved the way for a broader regional settlement that involves, for instance, a rapprochement between Eritrea and Djibouti. The Somali president visited Eritrea recently. The South Sudanese president visited Eritrea recently. So it's kind of led to a wave of leaders sort of coming back together and trying to sort out their problems that I think is really significant.
Are you surprised at the speed with which this has happened and almost kind of dominoes falling?
It is remarkable that in the space of really a couple months, right, that you could see all of this historic angst and rivalry just disappear. And I would say the biggest reason is that we've had new leadership emerge in Ethiopia that's really driving all of this. That is a central part of the story. None of this would have been possible had it not been for the rise of a new prime minister in Ethiopia, a guy by the name of Abiy Ahmed.
So tell us more about the leadership of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. He's the new prime minister in Ethiopia.
The prime minister has acted to fundamentally reshape Ethiopian political sphere by opening up political space. This was essentially functioned as a single-party state. That party is still in power, but armed opposition groups have been decriminalized. Thousands of political prisoners have been released. Exiled opposition politicians have come home. The prime minister has talked about free and fair elections in 2020. That's the next time that general elections are scheduled. I mean, it is a sea change in the political climate. I mean, it's palpable, right? Those domestic changes have gone hand in hand with this change in the broader regional environment. But the specific question of internally what's happening in the neighboring countries and are they catching the kind of democratization bug, I don't think there's really any clear evidence of that yet, but we'll see.
So let's just focus on Ethiopia for a minute, because in June, Prime Minister Ahmed lifted a block on some 200 Ethiopian websites, blogs, and television stations, and many of those were controlled by his opponents. Do you think he's genuinely open to some kind of national dialogue?
Of course, there were many members of the ruling party, factions in the ruling party that opposed the maneuvers that he's taken. I mean, this has been a bit of a high wire act by the prime minister, and I think that is an illustration of his commitment. The ultimate proof of this government's commitment to substantive reform will depend on free, fair, and orderly elections scheduled in 2020. Right. So I think the real proof will be what happens when this government's power is actually challenged at the ballot box by rivals.
So just looking at Ethiopia and Eritrea for a moment, the border between these two countries has been heavily militarized for decades. As far as getting access to those ports for Ethiopia, when will that border finally open?
The first Ethiopian vessel to dock in an Eritrean port in over 20 years just occurred a few days back, right? Of course, sustainable peace and economic development in this historically volatile region, I mean, it's not really possible unless we actually see internal political reforms across a number of countries. And of course, we hope the democratization process works in Ethiopia, and we hope in neighboring countries that can be replicated as well, right? That is a real path to durable peace.
Well, certainly seems that at least one of those countries has started it.
Absolutely.
Michael Woldemariam at Boston University, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
By 2045, the world's fifth largest economy will run only on carbon-free electricity. That's the plan anyway. And that economy, by the way, belongs not to a country, but to California. Governor Jerry Brown has signed new legislation requiring that California's electric companies phase out fossil fuels completely over the next quarter century. It's part of the state's commitment to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement, despite President Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of it. The California measure comes as a global climate summit is being held in San Francisco. The gathering is meant to rally support for much more aggressive action on the climate crisis. This week on the show, we're hearing from some of those people who've traveled to San Francisco for the summit. Today's voice comes from a participant in a march there over the weekend.
My name is Leo Cerda. I come from the Quechua region in the Amazon of Ecuador. In our territories, we depend solely in our resources, our water, our rivers, our land, and we are directly impacted by climate change because the fossil fuels are being extracted from our communities. Our rivers are being poisoned and polluted, our people get sick, so we are firsthand impacted by other countries that need the fossil fuel to exist. I think marches like this represent the hope for the next generations. We want to be able to be the voice of the indigenous people in the South and march together to say that we are here, we are alive. I think it's about time to make policy changes, and decision makers need to change into green renewable energy. We need definitely to find a way to generate energy without affecting communities all over the world. So the United States just withdrew from the Paris Agreement, and I think it's a huge step back, but the United States is not the only country in the world. Small cities, states can stop burning fossil fuels and start to find a way in which we can all live in a better planet with better solutions, green solutions that are not affecting our communities.
Leo Cerda is in San Francisco for the Global Climate Summit there this week. For more first-person climate change stories, check out our Instagram feed. We are at PRI The World. When you think of archives, you usually think of history on paper, you know, documents, photos, maybe video and audio recordings. But this weekend, the Arkansas State Archives are looking at the history of the state through the lens of food at their Foodways Symposium. And part of that culinary landscape has been Chinese food, maybe for longer than you would imagine. Well, for a landlocked state like Arkansas, anyway. Kevin Kim is from Arkansas. He also loves food. He's a PhD student in American Studies at the University of Maryland, and he's been interviewing Chinese grocers and restaurant owners all around the Mississippi Delta to find out the history of culinary traditions in the region. He'll be presenting his findings at the archives in Little Rock this weekend, complete with a cooking demonstration. I'm not dissing Arkansas, Kevin, but I don't think Arkansas when I think Chinese food.
And you know what? You're not the only person. I was in that boat and I grew up there.
Wow. Okay. So tell us the story. How did the Chinese first come to Arkansas and the Mississippi Delta?
So the Chinese are first introduced to the Delta by cotton planters who, at the end of the Civil War during the construction, were looking for what they termed docile non-political labor. A sort of cabal of these cotton planters got together and went to Guangdong.
In China?
In China and began bringing laborers over, in addition to the Chinese who were already in places like California. So they came to the Delta. They began working in the cotton fields, but what the cotton planters thought were docile labor was anything but. They see the harsh working conditions, so they left. Some of them returned to California. Some of them went back to Guangdong in China, but a fair amount remained. The Chinese who decided to stay in the Delta saw a business opportunity. They saw that a lot of the African-American workers just didn't have access to groceries. And when they did, they went through the plantation who overcharged for every little thing. And so they saw a niche and they began opening small sort of five and dime grocery stores.
Was there any overlap between Chinese produce and African-American tastes?
Sometimes, you know, they'll put one or two items, Chinese items like soy sauce or canned water chestnuts, and they would see that it was selling and they would stock more. And then they might, you know, add some more Chinese goods. So there was at times this experimentation.
Yeah. So kind of tastemakers of a sort in grocery stores. What about in Chinese run restaurants? What would you see on the menu? How would that translate?
So one of the restaurant owners that I interviewed, the owner of Hao Joy, which is unfortunately closed now, it used to be sort of a fixture of the Greenville restaurant scene. He was keen to point out that, you know, on the menu were a combination of what we would think of as Chinese here in America, the sort of takeout staples, chow mein, shrimp and lobster sauce. In addition to that, they also serve Western food. But what's interesting, for example, with the case of Hao Joy, is when they served, you know, a good old-fashioned American steak, they would glaze it with a little oyster sauce, which is, you know, quite common to do in Cantonese cuisine to give it a sort of a richer flavor. And people loved it. It was one of their more popular dishes. So even when these Chinese restaurants would cook what we would call American foods, there's obviously nothing more American than a good old fashioned ribeye steak. They would add little touches of Cantonese.
I mean, the whole idea of American Chinese, that's been going on in many parts of the country for decades. What do you think stands out in terms of Chinese food in Arkansas?
The first thing I think of when I think of Delta Chinese food is the affinity of both the Cantonese and the Delta South towards the pig, right? Pork is king. And, you know, Cantonese style barbecue pork is a staple. Hoover Lee down in Louise, Mississippi, came up with the Hoover sauce, which is a glorious combination of Cantonese-style barbecue with American-style barbecue.
Wow.
And it's a sauce that you shellac onto chicken and pork.
That sounds really good.
It is. I'm starting to get very hungry, which is a common side effect of my work. Similarly, something called yakka main, this interesting combination of spaghetti noodles in a meat broth flavored with soy and Worcestershire and good old Tabasco or Crystal hot sauce. You know, I've had fried rice served with country ham. That's also a very popular sort of common thing to see on the Delta Chinese table.
All right, let's get hungrier, Kevin, and go to the key question here. This weekend, what are you going to make for the cooking demo in Little Rock?
Yeah, it's a sort of a combination of traditional and not so traditional Chinese Cantonese food. We're going to start with some char siu bao, which is Chinese barbecued pork buns, then beef tomato, which is a traditional sort of Cantonese combination, roast chicken Chinese style with sides of stir-fried vegetables, Cantonese style mushrooms, and ham fried rice, and for dessert, some almond cookies.
It sounds fabulous. I wish I could make it. But bon appetit. Kevin Kim, a PhD student at the University of Maryland, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
I got to figure out how to hack that Hoover sauce. Anyway, that's it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.